Hi, everybody, and welcome to Tapped into Psychedelics. I'm your host, Adam Tapp, and with me today is my friend and producer, Sid Sation. And our guest today is Greg Wren, who's an American writer, Harvard-educated, and associate professor at the James Madison University, and was the former Wallace Steiner Fellow in Poetry. How are you doing, Greg?
I'm doing great. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, so, you know, I got introduced to you because I would imagine a publicist or something had sent me information about a book that you had recently done called Mothership, A Memoir of Wonder and Crisis. And so, you know, I read it and was moved at various points within this book. And I'm really happy that you're here right now so that we can have a discussion on the entire literary work as a whole and all the things that stem from that, which is, you know, as it happens, quite a bit. So, you know, normally when I'm interviewing someone, I say, well, let's discuss how you ended up into this place to be working with psychedelics. But oddly enough, your book is fundamentally about that. So let's sort of get into this concept. Now, I don't necessarily want you to just go on a diatribe and regurgitate your book, but sort of let's give us an idea of what your book fundamentally is at its core and how you ended up writing it. And let's start with that as sort of a goal for the next little bit.
Well, it's really glad to, I'm very happy to be here, very glad to be here. And I would say that the book is, really, there are lots of ways to talk about it, but I would say one way to talk about it that's especially relevant to your podcast and our shared interests is that this tells the story of how someone comes to psychedelics. Like it's very easy to call up a trip report on Reddit and read it, but to sort of see how psychedelic use, how therapeutic psychedelic use, how that fits into a life, right? Into a life lived. Like how does someone get to the point where the only option left is to use psychedelics?
Well, and you illustrate that so beautifully. You know, like the way that you write and the constant vivid picture that is being painted in your psyche as you're going through this book. Like I was on a roller coaster of emotions throughout it. Like towards the end, I was crying, and then, you know, like it was a powerful read, and I appreciated how you were able to string this together so cohesively. And you're right, you're painting a picture of how someone as a child moving through their life and their experiences and how everything is so profoundly complicated and yet linked together leads to this point where, yeah, the only seeming option was these psychedelic experiences and this medicine work that you engaged in. And then even your description of that was quite beautiful. And
thank
so
you.
For
thank
those
you. Yeah.
The people who haven't read the book, I suggest you read it. But let's just give some cold notes to sort of what happened with this. So, like, you know, you grew up, you had an interesting childhood. If you want to elaborate very briefly on that, please, by all means.
Sure. Sure. It was an interesting childhood. Yes, it was an interesting childhood, and it's not one I'm really going to dwell on so much today with you, but suffice it to say that I left adolescence with complex PTSD, which is, I like to call it a disorder of trust. I talk about that in my book.
That's the first time.
And so what I mean by that is it's the result of prolonged repeated abuse from which the victim cannot escape. So that is complex PTSD. That's sort of the shorthand definition of it. So what happens is you, like, bonding itself, like a veteran might, when they hear a gunshot, they might have panic attacks or they might be triggered from that, right? For someone like me with complex PTSD, the very act of bonding with another person can be panic inducing. And then the other sort of more classic PTSD symptoms like hypervigilance, flashbacks, so on and so forth, that or that feeling of just like not being able to be clean enough of feeling dirty. Those were all symptoms for me. So I entered adulthood with a very impaired ability to bond with people. Like, I could do it in the moment, right? I could flirt with someone. I could have a one-night stand. Yeah. I could show up at 2 hours, you know.
Yeah, you show up with this sort of contrived exterior version of yourself, and then when it's time to be vulnerable, then things sort of melt, and you're like, yeah, I don't know how to be vulnerable with people anymore, or if ever, maybe.
No, and not only do I not know how to be, but when I try to be, it can be immobilizing, and it can be it was just scary. Being in relationships has always been scary for me. When I say, you know, a lot of people could say that it's scary to be in relationships, but it's panic inducing. It's not just scary, but it's panic inducing. And so I, you know, through much of my adult life, I walked a suicidal path, like many of your listeners might understand. I walked a suicidal path and put myself in a lot of danger. But I had a meditation practice, right? I had incredible teachers in high school and in college. I had people who believed in me. I did have friends. It's just I was always at a remove, always trying to recover from, you know, from interactions with people. So what did I do? I started to go someplace 10,000 miles from where I grew up, which is Indonesia, to these remote islands where in silence with no one around me, underwater, I spent time with coral reefs. And those coral reefs, a bit like equine therapy, right? Where you learn to trust again, you learn to care again, you learn to feel safe in your body again. I learned a lot about finding that foundation of safety in my body. I was not cured or anything like that, but it gave me tastes of what ayahuasca would later give me in a very full-blown way. And I should say, I love this little parallel. You know, coral is a partnership of a jellyfish-like creature, an animal. It's a partnership of an animal and a plant.
Yeah, it's a symbiosis. The plant being, is it not? Yeah.
Symbiosis, right? Yeah. So the plant is embedded in its tissues. And it photosynthesizes and the animal benefits from that. So anyway, it's a partnership of animal and plant. Ayahuasca is a partnership of a vine and a plant, a vine and the ayahuasca vine and the chacruna leaf. And so that's also a partnership. And so, and I just love the, I love the ingenuity of nature, right? I love the combinations that sort of come together miraculously, the permutations that arise miraculously, seemingly miraculously, and create an ecosystem that can be seen from outer space in the case of coral, and in the case of ayahuasca, a medicine that's also, in my opinion, in my experience, an eco-sacrament. And so, right, and enables, I don't know, kind of astral
projection
openings,
projection
to take place, and an incredible healing to take place. So those coral reefs really helped me a lot, but I still was in a really bad place for much of my adult life. And then I turned 40 or so, and then I was really in a scary, scary spot, and found my way miraculously in a lot of ways after reading Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. I found myself in Peru. And I started to work with ayahuasca there, and my life started to change in big ways.
So, and here's an interesting thing. Because of your capacity to describe things so eloquently, you know, and you do so in your book very adequately, but So you describe a childhood of complex PTSD and very significant emotional injuries being passed down, generational trauma through your mother and father and all these different mm-hmm. things. You know, you find
sexual abuse, emotional abuse. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and then you find solace in these coral reefs and these beautiful natural environments where there's unconditional acceptance within this natural ecosystem. And there's not these judgments. There's not, you know, these placations and this and back and forth and these weird manipulations that occur in human dynamics. And then you find yourself with ayahuasca and you draw these parallels from ayahuasca back to these reefs. And I love hearing people who are capable of telling a beautiful story describe what ayahuasca does, what it does inside you, mm-hmm. how it pulls these things out of you. And so please, by all means, with whatever amount of depth, mm-hmm. time, accuracy, how did ayahuasca pull this from you? And did it use mm-hmm. your pre-existing memories of the coral reefs? Did it work with that sense of tranquility and perfection mm-hmm. that exists under the waves? Like, how did that work for you?
That's a great question. I will say that I have not ever taken an ayahuasca journey where I was underwater. I don't have many flashbacks to being underwater. I think there were a few moments where I remembered certain pockets of coral on a reef that spoke to me. I mean, like literally, like it. I mean, but that was in the moment. Like yeah. I didn't need ayahuasca. Like there were times underwater, long before I ever tried a psychedelic, where I felt like I was being seen. Right, in Hinduism they call it darshan, where God is looking at you. And in this case, in the case of coral, also smelling me, sniffing yeah. me with its, you know, with its
chem receptors,
with its receptors. And, yeah. yeah, right, exactly. So that sense of darshan, right, like of God seeing you, of the divine seeing you, like I think the reefs prepared me to receive, to be perceived in that way, and to know that I was being perceived by an entity beyond my understanding. And I think the coral reefs also prepared me to be in an alien realm. Right. And yeah. so I dove into the ocean. I dove into the depths of the ocean, but I also dove into the depths of my psyche and into my heart. And so what I found there was so much trauma. Oh my goodness. And when I said, you know, trauma, we throw that word around. What I mean by that is like traumatic memories. Right, traumatic memories, and you know, many people listening will probably be able to relate to this. You know, so many traumatic memories coming up, and yet, I guess, like, you know, like a coral reef, or like the ocean, the basic goodness, the basic righteousness. I love that word applied mm-hmm. to ayahuasca. The basic righteousness and the basic goodness. The justice, you could even say, that ayahuasca creates as a field in which you're enveloped, you know, that kept me going. And so, and what I later realized is that was a female entity. That was Madre Ayahuasca. Even when I was reliving traumatic memories, you know, I knew the science, right? I knew that, yes, ayahuasca does bring up traumatic memories. And thank goodness it brings them up, because then the fear that's embedded in those memories can be liberated, and those memories can reconsolidate without as much fear. And they can actually take on some of the beauty, some of the safety and the comfort of your set and setting, wherever you are, whatever center you're at, whoever you're sitting with. So I think that you know, as I talk about very openly in the book, and I won't go into any details, but you know, my mother abused me. My mother abused me until I was 17. And so I had a really I had a really fucked up internalized mother, because we all internalize models, working models of our parents. And I had a really fucked up mother inside of me, internal mother. And so what ayahuasca did is it replaced some of that original maternal imprinting with hers, with Madre Ayahuasca's imprinting. Like, she re-imprinted me. And I talk about this, I talk about this in the book, and I, you know, I think of myself as a fairly rational person, but that's what happened. And I will, I can't say that I've completely forgotten the difficult things from the past, or I don't still remember the difficulty of it at all. That's not it. It's just, now that I have a new basic sense of dignity, I have a new basic sense of dignity and self-worth, because I carry the spirit of that mother inside of me. I have a new internalized maternal model inside of me, and I don't do the stupid shit I used to do as a result.
So that was a very eloquent way of phrasing that. And did that work? I got right. A little emotional when you were talking. I was like, Jesus. I still am a little bit weepy. But you're right. Like, that's it. You know, like, you're born and you have parents, maybe two, maybe one, and you start imprinting, you know what I mean? Like, their behaviors imprint on you. And like, and you can see in the book your mother consciously, subconsciously passing down her own internalized traumas from her childhood onto you, and this continued cycle that probably has been repeated for how many generations. And you see it throughout the entire book, where you paint this very beautiful and eloquent picture of what CPSD does to you over this period of time.
Yeah.
And then the consequences throughout your relationships, and I'm not going to use the term debasement by any means, but you seem to go through fair enough. Debasement of oneself, and then this sort of delusionment of what sexuality is. And then you sort of using that as an example of, you know, the mother ayahuasca basically replacing that tarnished female energy that was imprinted inside you with this healthy, loving version. It was fucking perfect, man. Well said. See, that's why I do these podcasts, so people can say shit like that. Because that has meaning to it. Because people, you know, there's so many people who need.
They need
this.
To know.
Yeah, and you don't. You don't have to have your childhood to have issues. You had issues.
No.
A very significant childhood. You know, you were suicidal at various points in your life. But everything is difficult. Parents aren't perfect. There is a constant generational trauma being passed in this. And I see it constantly. This subconscious manipulations that children observe consciously and subconsciously from their parents that come out and how they raise children. And it's this continuation of a cycle. And I look now and I'm like, how long has this been going on? You know what I mean? Like, how many generations has this shit been going on? And now we're in this beautiful moment in history where we can address it. And
we can.
And stop.
We have options.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Just like after a psychedelic journey, like,
yeah,
you have options. You can go back to doing exactly what you were doing before.
Yeah.
Or you can try another way, a way that's gentler, calmer, more connected, more generous. You know, like, you get to decide. And so, you know, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, when my mom was growing up, these medicines weren't available.
No, and even talking about your feelings were stigmatized. You know what I mean? If she had said anything about how she felt, she would have been ridiculed by any number of people in society, told she was probably in hysterics, as in air quotes.
Right.
And that would have been it.
Yeah.
And yet, and here we are now having a conversation, which is highly vulnerable, about generational trauma and sexual abuse.
Yeah.
And that's powerful. And a mechanism that allows you to go into your body and analyze this and let go of it. And you describe in your book,
let go. That's a great word.
Isn't it though? Isn't that always, because I
stop
find
talking about it. Let it go.
Yeah. Like, and that's the problem in an absence of psychedelics. If you're even able to get to that place where that fear is, you just seemingly are skirting the surface and trying to find ways to confront it, when the reality is, it's not about confrontation. It's about acknowledgement and letting go of it, and just acceptance, and then replacing that with some form of self-love. And that's an oversimplification of a psychedelic experience, but fuck, not really. You know, like in yours, when you describe and sort of chronicle your journeys, shit, man, they were filled with fear, and you could just feel this child inside yourself just writhing and being like, we're not going here, just fucking leave me alone. We're you know, we're good. No, yes. No. And then you as sort of the adult, yes, being like, no, man, we have to go in here. Just let me give you a hug, dude. Just let me give you a hug and let's work through this. And your whole book was like a beautiful example of that. And when I say that, you brought me to tears, it really did. Like, there was two points in that book where I was like on the couch and my daughter's sitting there and I'm like snotty. She's like, are you okay, daddy? And I'm like, I'm good, kid. I'm good. She's like rubbing my face and I'm like, Jesus, because that's it. There's something very beautiful about vulnerability in subject matter that the vast majority of people try to avoid talking about, confronting, acknowledging within themselves. Mm-hmm. And
I've always been a taboo breaker. I've always been a taboo breaker.
Mm-hmm. No, fair enough. And I got asked this question too, and we had discussed this previously, is that, so what inspired you to write this book? You know what I mean? Because like most people would not write a book that airs their entire, you know, traumatic life and experiences. And, you know, because a lot of your book isn't flattering, and nor should it be, because that's not what life is. Life is not one beautifully flattering moment after the next. It's fucking ugly and it's sad. It's filled with mistakes and traumas. And
that's right.
That's what you illustrate.
I talk to my students about this. You know, I teach memoir writing at my university, and I tell them, you know, if you're a narrator, if the narrator in your memoir isn't willing to reveal embarrassing aspects of themselves, then like your reader isn't going to trust that voice.
Well, no, because
you
it's
know
so,
you have to.
Yeah, it's being narrated by insecurity. It's, you know what I mean. It's like it's being narrated by the insecurity that doesn't allow me to show some sort of fault within myself. And that's
right.
That's obvious. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to. To gain that trust between narrator and reader, you have to, you have to show aspects of yourself that you're not as proud of, you know, that you wouldn't necessarily talk about at a cocktail party, and that I think I've just always been that person. I've always been, you know, I came out of the closet when I was in the deep South, in the 90s. I'm just someone who, you know, I think growing up in the family that I did, you know, I came to fear silences, because I equated silence with the perpetuation of abuse and violence. But in terms of like why I wrote this book, I would say this is the perfect answer, right, for your podcast. You'll understand. I don't think you'll judge me. Honestly, the last third of the book, which deals squarely with plant medicine use, that was channeled. The medicine helped me do it. I mean, we know that, I mean, just speaking kind of, you know, neurobiologically, kind of very scientifically, we know that ayahuasca calms down the amygdala, right?
It reduces
anxiety and enables you to face aspects of yourself that you wouldn't otherwise want to face. A bit in some ways, you know, like MDMA, but very, very different. So you're able to approach really difficult material. And so I know that the medicines enabled me to learn how to tell a story. See, I'm a trained poet. I've never taken storytelling.
See, I was going to ask that too. Yeah, because the Wallace Steiner Fellowship is in poetry, and not to suggest that these two things can't coexist together, but you told one fuck of a story in this memoir.
No, I hate telling stories. Yeah, like I always thought of myself as someone who can't tell a good story. Like I was never trained to tell a story. I never really wrote narrative poetry. So for good reason, because I didn't want to tell my story, right? I wanted to hide, in a sense, behind metaphors and symbols.
Well, and there's another big part of that too, like the innate catharsis that comes with writing that story and then saying, holy fuck, here world, here is a book that chronicles my traumas, my abuse, my shortcomings as a human and my redemption. Like you're opening up the arguable most vulnerable part of your existence for perspective of the world. And I know that all of us fear judgment, but more often than not, that judgment is actually not reflected in the values that we believe they will be. And I read your book and I didn't judge you at all. I saw this beautiful story of redemption and to some degree coming of age, which is interesting as a grown ass man, but coming to age through the repressed maturity of having childhood abuse, right? Like it was a beautiful story.
Well, I think another reason I'm as vulnerable, I'm as self-revealing as I am in the book is to show people, to make the case that nature is a mental health resource.
Yeah.
And I have to show you that I was real fucked up. I need to show you that I experienced trauma with a capital T. Like, I need to show you that. I need to show you the depths of my wounds in order to show you the heights that these medicines, the heights of the healing power of these medicines, if that makes sense.
And like, I think you spared the reader with some depths of the trauma you endured as well. I'm going to be honest with you. And
there's a lot I don't even talk about.
Perhaps thankfully. Yes. But yeah, like it's...
Yes. Euphemisms are our friend.
Are
right?
they though?
But they're our friend. But I think the last third, you know, I know this isn't the most, you know, please don't quote me on this person out there in the universe who's not part of this world, but yeah, it was channeled. I mean, it really, the last third of the book was channeled and I just, it just wrote itself so quickly. And a lot of it I wrote when I was in, when I was in Peru on lockdown in a spiritual community. And so I was actually working with, and this isn't what I talk about in the book at all. I don't touch on this, but I was working with Bufo, and Bufo, helped me so much with just, I mean, the metaphor I always like to go back to with Bufo in my case is, you know, it's like on a science fiction movie on the space station where the airlock just kind of blasts open. It's like that. It's just like the airlock opened and all this shit
just sucks out.
Was sucked out into outer space, never to be seen again. And I think a lot of very, very early trauma, even birth trauma. I mean, there have been plenty of people who've talked about this with Bufo, that plenty of birth trauma was released when I was working with Bufo, which is to say how I integrated both the ayahuasca ceremonies that I had just had. I'd been on a long dieta, and then I came to the Andes, rented a house, worked with Bufo, was on lockdown, and then I had all the time to myself to just write. Mm.
Yeah.
And I did. And I did. And then my love and I were, you know, going on our second date over FaceTime. And and so my now husband Tony really helped me just keep it together, even though I wasn't telling him anything about my history.
And honestly, the end
so
of
I had that
book,
loving presence.
The end of your book when there was a big portion of your book talking about you spinning your tires, trying to find love, trying to be authentic with people and being unable to.
Yeah.
And then the last part of the book of having this authentic relationship with Tony was beautiful. It was just like, yeah, man, that's what that looks like, is being authentic with yourself so that you can be authentic with another. And that level of vulnerability that you're able to achieve. And now, and one other thing too I want to address is for you know, I like to think that a variety of people who listen are thoroughly educated and not so thoroughly educated and everything in between. Bufo would be a natural version of 5-MeO-DMT that is secreted from the parotid glands of the Colorado River toad. And it is fundamentally at its core 5-MeO-DMT with a bunch of other alkaloids. And it is the fucking rocket ship of psychedelics as far as I'm concerned. And that idea that you were talking about, how like birth trauma, like to me, a lot of other psychedelics, I look at it this way. So like you're born and you don't really have memories till you're like three and a bit. And it's almost as if because that's when you start forming memories around language and things that you understand. But previous to that, you still maintain these things. And it's almost as if a lot of psychedelics work with how you store memories as an adult and as an adolescent. Whereas 5-MeO simply just goes to the core of your existence. There is no limiting factor or regulation with that substance. It just gets in and pulls things out. And you're talking about birth traumas. And I'm like, yeah, man, I know what you're talking about. Where it's like, you can't define it. There's no, the emotions with it don't even have meaning or anything because you haven't had a chance to give meaning to emotion with your development intellectually. And that's when it gets into very murky territory. And that's an interesting thing that you're talking about, because very infrequently have I touched on that topic, because well, finding someone to have that conversation with is not always super easy too, because it comes off as being esoteric, but it really isn't once you've had that experience.
No.
Yeah.
No, it's not esoteric. And to me, it's not esoteric. And yet there's so much about the Bufo experience that I don't understand. But that's, I mean, it's taking you to a non-dual space. So by definition, it's not
shouldn't understand
really.
It anyways.
We we can't really have much of a conversation about it. I mean, we can, but
And I've always said the same thing about 5-MeO and psychedelics in general. The moment you try to describe a psychedelic experience, you're taking something that cannot really be described with human vernacular, and you're putting in this little fucking box with descriptions. And that is true for psychedelics, but incredibly true for 5-MeO-DMT, because it is devoid of experience. That's what 5-MeO is it the absence of anything by its very nature.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you get into
I had a really hard time with that. Trust me. I had my ego had a really hard time with nothing, with the nothingness or the lack of concepts. I blacked out. I mean, every time I did it, there was a period of time where I blacked out, and I was sort of, apparently I was saying, help me. which sounded pitiful and terrible, but I apparently had a huge smile on my face.
Well, it's,
so it was, I don't know what went down, but a lot went down, and I don't care. All I know is I don't do the stupid shit I used to do. I just don't.
And that's all that you need to take away from it. You know what I mean? Like, it's so many people try and I want to know what happened and I did this and I blacked out. I'm like, yeah, but you're off all your anxiety medications. You're having healthy relationships. You're not acting out and engaging in self-destructive behavior. So does that not overshadow the fact that you can't find an explanation for what happened?
No. And I actually think those like lower doses of Bufo, I think that is really interesting. I mean, that's something I'd really like to work with, but I haven't had an opportunity to do that. But really, really bringing the Dharma, right? Bringing the Buddhist teachings, to Bufo
it's vaguely
funny interesting
that, you know, 5-MeO-DMT is legal in Canada, which is wonderful. And I am very familiar with that substance. And we initially were doing these stupid high doses, like disappear, ego death. And I'm not entirely sure why that was our programming for this, probably because that's how we got exposed to it. But more recently, in the last couple of years, it's all been these lower 5 milligram of synthetic doses where you consciously make the decision to interact with something and let go of it. And it becomes a lot more palpable. And I find healing, like, fair enough. There's something really profound about having an ego death, but that, you know, okay, you have one, you have two, and then you're ceasing really to play in what is functional and relevant. And I find more often than not, you just stop having them. And in these lower doses, you know, maybe doing 5 milligram spacing out, 5 milligram spacing out, 5 milligram, and being able to go in and consciously address and let go of things or let go of yourself, making the decision to do so is, for me, a lot more cathartic and beautiful. And I, I totally encourage you to go down that path if you have the opportunity, man. Like,
yeah. Well, I'll need to find somewhere, you know, where it's legal.
Just north of you, man. You know, it's, just north of you.
Hey, just north of the border. Yeah. So So to circle back to your question, you know, the book, the last third of it was channeled, but then just revising all of it, right? I had already written these chapters. I had written chapters of this book before I had even encountered ayahuasca, but they weren't written in the style of a memoir. They were written as essays that weren't so personal. Yeah. So really the medicine not only helped sort of channel the last third of the book about ayahuasca, but then it really guided my hand, as you know, in the revision process, and helped me shape it into a story, like into a story, as opposed to a prose poem or some sort of experimental avant-garde lyric essay or something.
Yeah.
No, like it's got a clear beginning, middle, and end.
Oh, it does.
There's dialogue. It's, there's a plot. I tried to make it move quickly.
I would have thought from reading it that it was done. You had all your experiences. You had the epiphany. You created the structure and you wrote it in one single moment, as opposed to what you're talking about in this weird sort of skeletized it posts pre. Like it was very fluid. I thought it was lovely, to be honest with you.
Thank you very much. And well, yeah, so I mean, it just goes to show you can use these medicines to teach yourself new skills, you know, whether it's storytelling, whether it's nonviolent communication, whether it's learning a new language, whether it's learning a musical instrument. You know, these medicines reopen the critical periods of development in our brains. And so, you know, learning a language, learning a new skill, learning how to be with people. I mean, I feel like that was a big part of my healing post ceremony, was to practice being in relationship, because I was dealing with CPTSD, so that was my work. I didn't need to learn how to, you know, build a boat or something. What I needed to do was learn how to actually be with people and be in relationship and learn to tolerate the inevitable discomfort of that, because certainly I had learned to tolerate the discomfort of ayahuasca. So actually human relationships seemed like small potatoes compared to that.
Well, and I would say something else too, is like, you know, in your book, there's only sort of a handful of ayahuasca ceremonies that you describe pertaining to your growth. But how many did you do in total before you had, and I achieved a goal, whatever, however you want to phrase that, but until you got to a point where you felt, well, fuck the end of your book. When you were having a healthy relationship with your now husband, like how many ceremonies had you done? Like, because I think I'm just trying to paint a picture of it is a lot of fucking work.
What it takes? Oh, it was a lot of fucking work. It was a lot of fucking work. Honestly, it was about 30.
Yeah, man.
30 ceremonies. It was about 30 ayahuasca ceremonies in addition to some of the other medicines I've mentioned. So it's, you know, I mean, the book is called Mothership, and I do think of being in ayahuasca ceremonies as a practice, and it is something that you need to do with intention, obviously. But you are learning. But someone seeking their pilot's license, also for them flying a plane is a practice.
Yeah.
And so really it's almost like learning how to fly a spaceship that you don't. Yeah. Ayahuasca is like learning how to pilot a spaceship that you're not really even piloting.
No,
you're kind of maybe got your hand on the tiller in the back, sort of. Or you can make suggestions to the captain.
It's almost like you're learning how to be present in a fucking crazy chaotic environment just to allow it to work and do its thing and accept what's happening.
Yeah. Right. And I might direct it sometimes. I'll say, no, we're not going there again.
Yeah.
You know, I'll talk to the medicine sometimes. But yeah, I mean it is. It's like being in a kind of chaotic situation and being the eye of the storm. So in a way, maybe it's less that you're the ship or piloting a ship and you're learning how to be the ship or how to be the ocean.
Well, and it goes down to like Taoist ideas, right? Where it's just be the water. You know what I mean? Stop struggling.
Yeah.
Just simply go with the flow and the motion of the universe as opposed to contriving and twisting and contorting constantly, as we all do. And if that statement doesn't reflect you at all, then chances are you haven't done any psychedelics to have enough of that sort of self-realization to be like, every moment of the day, we're all contorting and shifting and twisting based on our programming that we've all become habitual with. So,
yeah. And I think I just do want to say one more thing that's important, I think, is that for me, because I didn't have a recreational drug history, but I had a very, pretty strong spiritual practice, I saw myself as a patient. I saw myself as a psychic. When I first showed up in the Amazon, I saw myself as a psychiatric patient because I was a psychiatric patient. I wasn't a thrill seeker. I wasn't even an explorer, although that's in me too, being an explorer. For me, it was like, I don't want to die. Like, I want to be here and I want to save my life. But then as the healing started to happen and deepen, that's when I started really moving away somewhat, although I think I'll always be a patient when I show up to ayahuasca. I think I moved a bit away from that paradigm into one of exploration.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Star Trek fan.
Oh, dude, so am I. I love Star Trek.
For me, okay, great.
Next Generation.
Yeah. So, or is it that? No, anyway.
We got this covered. Yeah.
Yes. Don't you dare put that thumb out that way.
Well, I can do it with this one that just looks weird.
This one. Yes. Okay. A little long password. So I'm a huge Star Trek fan. Obviously, E.T. plays a big role in my memoir, Mothership. So as time went on, I approached my journeys, my ayahuasca journeys, more as an explorer, and also as a devotee, it became a space in which I prayed, and so, I prayed for the world. I prayed for healing that had nothing to do with my wounds, healing for other people. And so it's amazing how many there's so many ways in which this medicine can be used. It can be a sacrament. It can be a spaceship for exploration. It is for me, at least, has certainly been a medicine for complex trauma. But I'm so interested to hear from other people, what's that paradigm been like for other people?
It's always so unique.
People may have all different ideas on it.
Like how similar and yet how profoundly different because of the complexity of each of us as an individual. And it could never be the same, but yet there are the similar themes and tropes that go throughout individual people's journeys and what they're seeking. But I think at the core of all of our being, we just want to be loved and accepted. And however we get to that place is very different depending on how we grew up, and we're all traumatized in some way, and we all have our own weird insecurities and all these weird ideas and why we shouldn't be loved. But we're all trying to get to the same place. And it looks very different sometimes, but yet it looks very similar. You know what I mean? Like we're all just struggling in a profoundly dangerous universe, trying to achieve something in a short period of time and be accepted and loved during that process. And I think that's just...
It's always been dangerous.
Indeed.
It's always been dangerous. People think, things aren't right now. I mean, they're not right now, right? This is a planet that has so many crises, and there is a planetary emergency unfolding, to my eye. But yeah, it's always been dangerous.
Yeah, whether it was Spanish flu, Mongol hordes, fucking religious persecution, a cat bite, you know what I mean? Like being alive is profoundly dangerous.
Tetanus?
Yeah, man. Literally, being alive is profoundly dangerous. And we have these beautiful little manicured lives in which we create these illusions of safety. And yes, we are insulated from a lot of external harms that existed before, but that doesn't change the fact that we're all mortal and that your chicken could get punched any day of the week. And we've just replaced tetanus with different dangers, like driving a car every day. And you know what I mean? Like, again, you just take
mass shootings in the United States.
Yeah, fuck, I'm so happy I live in Canada. Jesus.
Or if you're a certain skin color, you're pulled over by the police and shot or whatever. So it's And so I think these medicines are, you know, they're coming at their emergence and their potential legalization in certain contexts in the United States. I mean, this is part of my mission, is to really advocate for the legalization of psychedelic assisted therapy in the United States and elsewhere. Yeah. You know, if we can enable these medicines to be available and safe and legal for folks, then I think that. I think it's going to help with our mental health crisis. I think people are going to be able to think more clearly about the pickle that we're in. Well, it's very hard to think about the pickle that we're in when you just can barely get out of bed in the morning.
Think about
it. And with good
reason. Yeah. You know, since the advent of like properly defined advertising, everything's about distraction. You know, look over here, jingle some keys. You know, you're sad about yourself and your position in life and your traumas. Here's something that fundamentally just allows you to tread water as opposed to figuring anything out. It's all about distraction, right? And in our previous conversation, like a big part of your book was the ecological crisis. Now, it was confined, I don't want to say confined, but it would locate itself within coral reefs and the bleaching and what's going on. But that is a microcosm of a greater concern with climate change and the destruction of natural habitat. And so, you know, in the book, you could see the anger that you have towards us as a destructive species. And now, did your ayahuasca journeys change how you perceive this ecological crisis to be? Because I feel like we have it like an entire generation of kids who have this existential fear that there will not be a planet left for them to inhabit, to inherit. Mm-hmm. And what's the point of having offspring when there's not going to be a planet for them to exist in? Mm-hmm. And then there's this continuing thing. Like, do you think that in some multifocal approach that psychedelics offer some sort of solution to both the anxiety as well as the solution to the problem itself?
I think it would be simplistic. I don't think you're necessarily suggesting this, but some people think this, right? That I think it would be simplistic for someone to think that psychedelics could sort of alone could change humanity enough that we could, avert ecocide, right? The killing of the planet. I think that's simplistic. And yet it's clear that what has to change, it's all internal. We need to work on our minds and heal ourselves. And then once we do that, things will be easier. I don't know about that. I mean, that's true in some sense, but you know, first off, these fossil fuel companies have got to be taken to task, and they must be dismantled. Period. Change your business plan. We don't need you to go out of business, but you need to find new sources of energy, and stop. Yeah. You know, stop it. Like. So let's stop talking about my personal carbon footprint, and let's talk about the carbon footprint of big
of
oil.
Exxon, I mean,
it's absolutely disgusting.
Of BP,
it's disgusting. BP, yeah. So it's so revolting the way that they have, you know, used misinformation to convince us that it's somehow we're at.
It's like we all got gaslit for a really long fucking time. You know what I mean?
Gaslit.
I know, and pun intended on there. Yes. It's like flat out. It's been like generations, but it's been like what, like fucking 5-6 decades of being fully blown gaslit by these energy companies. And I agree with you. Like, and a lot of the onus and anxiety has fallen to the individual. And fair, we all have some individual responsibility for this. It's not as if you can somehow remove yourself from that. But you know, there's Jon Stewart did an interesting interview with, I think it was ExxonMobil, one of the CEOs, and he was basically like, he's like, I view this from the perspective that we can't do this without you. But you guys need to have a seat at the table, these multi-billion dollar corporations. We all have to sit at the same table. We all have to, and have to figure out how to make this work so that you can profit, your shareholders will see the profit from some sort of green transition or revolution. So how do we make this happen? Because we can't kill you. You know what I mean? Like, we have to coexist.
No, we need energy. I mean, we need energy. We need some large multinational corporations who can deploy this and make it profitable. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that the medicines, psychedelics, but also just spending time in nature. Forget with or without psychedelics. It's just spending time in nature. The medicine of nature, however it manifests itself, whether it's in a psychedelic or just being outdoors, that can get us to a place of anger. You said in places in the book, I sounded angry, and I am angry.
Yeah.
And that's not a problem. I'm not suggesting that you thought it was, but that's not a problem. That's fuel. And that's fuel that helped me write the book. That's fuel that helps me show up and have this conversation with you and not go blue in the face. These are things that have to be talked about. And so let's not romanticize these medicines to think, oh, I'm going to be free of all my worries and it's going to be fine. No. As Don Jose Campos says, in his book, which I pull a quote from in my book, and I'm paraphrasing here, you know, ayahuasca takes away our defects, but it replaces those defects with responsibilities.
Yeah.
And we do have responsibilities. And having responsibilities sucks. It's not easy.
It does.
You don't want to do all
it's having to grow
but
up
you do.
And recognize that
it's
I
to
have
grow
to
up.
Play a
yes.
role in this. I can't just sit back and complain
yes.
about the situation of life by yes. not actively contributing to any
yeah.
outcomes. You know,
And I'm not a screamer. I'm not someone who necessarily goes to protests or something, but I think of this book as a form of activism, and I think about all the people who don't have a voice on this planet, especially in the developing world, but also in marginalized communities in North America. You know, like this is insane. It's like that Four Non Blondes song from the early 90s. What's going on?
Yeah. Really? Yeah.
Play that in the background.
Cue music. There we go. Well, and
yes,
you know, like I do think that there are such things as sociological tipping points. When even independent of psychedelics, if you have a movement or a theme that permeates into culture, it only requires a certain percentage of the culture before it to become a normal articulated thing within said group. And I feel like psychedelics have this unique capacity to bring you to nature, perhaps despite an inability to do so any other way. And it allows you to see the interconnectivity of everything and the relevance behind this. And again, I don't think that psychedelics are somehow going to save the world, but I do believe that if enough people let go of some baggage and have these beautiful experiences, that there could be some sort of sociological tipping point that occurs within a culture in which we start making more specific demands to what we expect.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because I think part of it is like everybody wants the environment to be safe, but I also don't want to fucking walk everywhere. I want to drive a car. I want to have steak a couple times a month. You know what I mean? Like it's those weird things of like, well, how do we do this? And how do we do it collectively as a whole and as a species? And I do think that psychedelics is like the epitome of grassroots anything, because you're taking people from the very core of their being and you're allowing them to change and become potentially more authentic and reflective of the natural world that we all stem from. And maybe if enough people have these experiences, you can see this interesting tipping point occur where our culture as a whole drifts towards a different perspective or mentality. Because I'm not seeing a whole bunch of movement right now, but, you know, it's hard to say, right?
Well, I think it's happening in the background. I think people aren't talking about it as much, but, you know, I think it's podcasts like yours that are, you know, people are, you know, there are people who are listening, who will listen to this podcast, who are frightened.
Yeah.
Like they're frightened to take these medicines, and they can listen to a podcast about it. You know, maybe late at night, they're drunk and high. It's like I'm talking to one of you listeners out there, future
listeners. Someone specifically, I can see your eyes. Yeah,
I can always see you. It's like you're drunk, you're high, you're scared shitless. You know you have to change your life. And, you know, there are lots of people who, and maybe they're in a conservative kind of church environment. Who knows who's out there listening to this? And yet they know that they have to change, you know, just like Michael Pollan's book, you know, How to Change Your Mind. They know they have to change their mind, that it's not external so much as something inside, but which is just to say, you know, I think some people are really in the closet about their psychedelic use and their interest in psychedelics. And I think that one of the things that I want to do, part of my work is to destigmatize it, because I can name, I can think of people who would still be alive if they had safe legal access to these medicines.
Yeah, so do I. You know what I mean? Like lots of people who, and, mm-hmm. and that's that funny thing is like, to me, I've had people ask me why I'm doing this. And primarily it is to reduce the stigma and have like a concise body of work that gets into the meat and grit, honestly having conversations about the pros and cons and the real nuances of psychedelics. Because shit, man, we have 50 years of government propaganda and then a burgeoning, aspiring psychedelic renaissance. And I hate to say this, but riddled with weird echo chamber propaganda that doesn't necessarily reflect what's going on. Like, fuck, I remember, you know, in high school thinking that psilocybin would make my brain bleed and that LSD, if I did like more than 10 hits consecutively in my life, I'd be clinically insane. And it's vaguely ironic that almost the polar opposite is true. Mm-hmm. But then you look on, you know, the emerging psychedelic propaganda, and it's, you know, you have this experience and it'll change you completely in this beautiful moment of magnificence. And it's like, well, that's not really true too, is it? You know what I mean? Like you had what, 30 deep before you actually got to a place. And like, I'm still working through things and I'm like 12
years.
Oh,
I'm still working through things.
You know
too.
What I mean? No, I'm not suggesting that. Yeah. But it's a grind. Mm-hmm. And I think people having conversations like this and acknowledging that it's a fucking grind, but it's the most worthwhile thing that I've ever done, you know, and for me to be a father and noticing that I'm stopping generational issues and that I'm a better person, and that's going to be a carried on, hopefully, to a planet that's not on fire. But fuck, you know, fingers crossed.
Maybe, yeah. I absolutely. And so there's hope. You know, that's no small thing. There's hope, and the, you know, the adult life of your daughter is that right? The adult life of your daughter will be very different from your adult life, but that's always been the case.
Yeah. And, you know, and there's always those old men lamenting the changes that have occurred through their life. And that's fine. You know what I mean? It's just, hopefully it's within reason, you know?
Hopefully. Or, you know, we may be living in space. I mean, you and I talked a little bit about that. But I do think if anyone's ever read, you know, Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, those science fiction books, you know, she envisions that possibility. And I think it's possible, but I also think that, you know, I think there's hope in these medicines. I think there's actually hope in artificial intelligence, in terms of coming up with some technical solutions.
Yeah.
But if you interact with ChatGPT these days,
you know, and once again, how a culture can make something with so much potential
develop a warp drive
into this weird. Let me show you kittens playing fucking poker and blackjack wearing tuxedos, because that's what I need in my life. But no, I agree with you. Like, you know, we're at this beautiful cusp in human history where our future is wrought with both peril and yet this beautiful avenues of enlightenment. And I think you require one to have the other. In some degree, right? Like one causes causational growth of the other. And here we are, and we have this, you know, this uncertain ecological future, and we have this resurgence of these plant medicines that have so much healing within them. And that as a whole is collective. And I think it's a beautiful time to be alive. You know what I mean? It really is.
Yeah. Sometimes I think that.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think that, but I'm, you know, but it's beautiful to, be alive, you know, it's beautiful to be alive. And, I don't know if there's an era I would rather be in, but it's, you know, it's beautiful to be alive, but it's easy to forget that with all of our screen time.
I know. I've been really trying to back off that, especially with my daughter. Because, like, you know, we were getting a coffee this morning, this coffee shop, and every fucking person in that place, and there was like 20 people, while they're all on their phones, and she's looking at me, and she's like, "Daddy, phone." And I'm like, "Kid, just play with me. We'll jazz hands." I don't know, man. And it's, yeah. But again, too, it's, you know, I hate to use the term waking up, but to some degree it is, you know, like psychedelic use allows mm-hmm. you to wake up perhaps from this weird sociological programming that perhaps was beneficial at some point, but is no longer. And that cultural programming has suited its needs. And now we need to change and try something different. And I'm excited mm-hmm. to be a part of whatever that change might be.
Me too. Me yeah. too. And I hope that people can find my book.
I will.
It'll be available in Canada, and I hope that people can enjoy the book and get some ideas for how to move forward in their lives and how we can move forward together. You know.
Yeah.
So that's my, I guess you could say, that's my prayer. That's my intention.
No, it works. And like I said, you know, like your book was stunning. Like it moved me to tears at several points.
Oh,
and it was beautifully, articulately well written, and it painted the picture that you needed to paint. And it was a stunning literary work on a coming of age novel, as I would describe that, as a memoir.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Yeah.
And so, Greg, again.
Well, I'll see you. I'm sure our paths will cross someday when I cross the border. Yeah. Someday to see the narwhals and
the magnificence
caribou,
of the maple syrup and beavers of the Northlands.
Magnificence and the beavers and all the, and you have wild blueberries there too.
You don't have wild blueberries? Seriously?
Not like you do. At Trader Joe's they sell blueberries from Canada, wild ones. You know?
Oh yeah, they're little tiny things, little pockets of magnificence.
Little tiny, yeah.
Yeah, you were missing out. Although you got to fight with bears for those. I'll be honest with you. North. Yeah, it's risky business. But anyways,
okay,
Greg,
no way, Jose.
I will leave a link to where our listeners can find your book. Again, I recommend it. It was lovely.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for your warm-heartedness and your passion and your visionary spirit. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.